This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 21, the Hock Lee Bus Litmus Test. One of the constant themes of this series has been that human nature hasn't changed. Then, as now, we live in a world filled with discrimination and racism and massive inequality. Then, as now, people were struggling to live and work and have families. Then, as now, companies were seeking to maximize profits and willing to overlook little things like workers' rights. A colonial society is a political system founded on the very principle of human exploitation to maximize profits. And so companies in colonial Singapore took its cue from the top and also happily exploited workers. As I said in episode 7, the colonial model of economic capitalism was based on exploitation of labor. The system as a whole was exploitative and ruthless. And in particular, after World War II, the British were desperate to revive Malaya's economy so that they could use the profits to rebuild Britain's shattered economy and pay off its war debts. In 1948, the Malayan Emergency got rid of the main force which was struggling for workers' rights, the Malayan Communist Party. Now, as always, it's important to acknowledge that the Malayan Communist Party were a violent, militant, anti-colonial organisation. But it's also important to remember that everything they did, the British also did. Murder, torture, violence, both sides are guilty. But it's also important to remember there was another very important reason for declaring the Malayan Emergency. Money. Money, 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 money. By struggling for workers' rights, the Malayan Communist Party drove the cost of labour up, cutting into the profits that the British needed to extract from Malaya to send home to Britain. And as official documents have shown clearly, in 1948 the British were not sure whether the MCP was behind all the killings, but they were definitely sure that the MCP had organised strikes for workers' rights, thus raising the cost of labour. So, was the Malayan Emergency declared to protect the peace, or was it declared to protect the profits? The answer, of course, is both. It is not surprising, then, that one major effect of the Malayan Emergency was to once again enable the exploitation of workers. All legitimate left-wing trade unions were banned. Only pro-government right-wing trade unions were allowed. But these were, obviously, terribly ineffective at protecting workers. Under the emergency regulations, workers could not strike or even assemble to protest. The security forces aggressively cracked down on any hint of labour activism. As such, businesses could, once again, gleefully fire workers at will, hire cheaper workers, force workers to work 18-hour days, cut their pay with no notice, deny them time off or even any modicum of dignity and respect. So, with the suppression of labour costs as well as massive unemployment, Singapore's economy picked up. By 1950, Singapore was back to where it had been in 1939, the glittering economic capital of Southeast Asia, one of the most prosperous cities in the British Empire, indeed in the whole world, the most important commercial, transportation and communications centre in the Far East. This rich, wealthy metropolis had a per capita income of $1,200 million, higher than nearly any other country in Asia. The famous economist Thomas Silcock noted in 1959 that Singapore was, quote, almost certainly the only place in Asia where there is really a substantial middle class, unquote. More than New York, London or Kolkata, it was the 20th century's first truly global city, a city of infinite ethnic fractions. But just as in 1939, these profits were built on the exploitation of labour. Singapore's workers were very poor. In 1957, 19% of Singapore households and 25% of individuals, that's over 360,000 people, were officially defined as in poverty. For a family of four, the poverty line was $101.85 per month. Yet the modal, that's the most common wage of male workers in regular employment, was about $100 to $120 per month, as compared to Singapore's mean, that's the average wage of $1,200 per month. And this difference reflects a massive, a really deep structural wage inequality. A 1953 Sinchujit Post study, for example, comparing Singapore to Britain, found that wages of senior civil servants in Britain were, on average, three times the wages of dock workers. I know that seems like not a lot today, but back then, that was the ratio. In Singapore, the ratio was doubled. It was 6-1. And furthermore, as the official Benham report on Malaya's national income noted, quote, the cost of living was appreciably higher in Malaya, unquote, than in the United Kingdom after adjusting for purchasing power parity. Overall, it was estimated the real income of Malayan blue-collar workers relative to purchasing power parity was a tenth of British workers. Both foreign and locally owned commercial firms were happy to follow the colonial government's lead in holding down wages and offering negligible benefits. This also put the Chinese community at odds with its traditional mercantile leadership. So the level of direct taxation was significantly higher in Britain, but in return, British workers enjoyed things like free healthcare, pensions, paid vacations, in addition to having twice the real wages of their Singapore counterparts. Singapore lacked any significant social welfare provisions. It had no minimum wage, little regulation of working hours or conditions. Some shop assistants received wages of only $15 to $28 per month. Others worked 15-hour days. But even a meager wage was beyond the reach of many, as there was widespread unemployment. Official statistics estimated unemployment at 5%, but this was achieved by counting anyone who averaged just 15 hours of work per week as being, quote-unquote, economically active. Remember, there are lies, damned lies in statistics. This economically active category included many temporary workers who were hired based on demand, such as construction and dock workers. It also included those subsisting as hawkers, trishaw riders, small traders, and nominal employees of small shops, trading concerns, and eateries. Many of these people were considered self-employed, even though they were reliant heavily on the vagaries of demand. Their livelihood was tied to global trade cycles of boom and bust, creating a precarious existence. Unemployment was also driven by a massive population increase, 3.3% from 1931 to 47, 4.4% from 1947 to 57, a rate which the government's reports called, quote, the highest in the world, unquote. Yet the government repeatedly denied that the unemployment problem was worsening. All these people scratched out a desperate life, just 1 or 2 miles from the gleaming colonial city, yet all but invisible to the European elite. The emergency was virtually over in Singapore by 1952, when slowly things recovered. Legitimate trade unions began to appear again. And in 1955, to the shock of the British government, Singapore's first and only free and fair election elected a pro-Labour government. On 26 April 1955, David Marshall rose to give his inaugural speech as Chief Minister. In his speech, he condemned how manual labourers earned a mere $31 per week despite Singapore's status as Asia's richest country with an income of over $2 billion. The Labour Front government announced that their first piece of legislation was to be a new labour ordinance. This would be unprecedented in Singapore. The British colonial government had always rejected legislation enforcing humane conditions for workers for the reason that, quote, local conditions make it difficult to enforce a uniform standard, unquote, which is a stupid reason. As with any new legislation, it would take time to write. But the worker anger which had swept them into power was already threatening to explode. The commitment of the new government to its pro-labour principles would be tested immediately. And when we return, we tell the story of Singapore's most famous, or infamous, riot, the Hockley Bus Riot. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Tham. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, the Hockley Bus Litmus Test. The Hockley Amalgamated Bus Company was notorious for exploiting its workers. When its manager, Kwok Sin Ing, was murdered on the 31st of December 1953, Special Branch actually complained that it was too hard to investigate the murder because of the sheer number of people who had a motive, the sheer number of people who hated the man, including all his workers. So it was no surprise when, in February 1955, around 250 of the 300 Hockley bus workers formed a union and affiliated it with the Singapore Bus Workers Union. They wanted to protect themselves from management. They were seeking better, they were seeking humane conditions of employment. As manager of Hockley, Kwok Sin Leong fired the two union organizers and accused the union of stirring up industrial unrest. The Bus Workers Union sought the reinstatement of their two organizers. Arbitrators ruled that one had to be reinstated, at which point a company director offered this guy 6 months' pay to resign, but the man refused. The Workers Union subsequently agreed to new terms of employment with Kwok on 4th of April. Remember this, is important. At this point, 4th April 1955, both sides had already agreed to new terms. Things could have ended here. Unfortunately, they didn't. Kwok instead quietly hired new employees on the condition they joined his new company union, paying them $2 a day to do nothing but wait. Once he had enough to replace all the bus worker union branch members, he reneged on the agreement. This forced the workers union, the bus workers union, to serve a strike notice on 22nd April. In response, Hockley sacked all 229 bus worker union affiliated workers on 24th April. The workers now had no choice. They angrily picketed the bus depot the next 2 days and blocked the buses from leaving. The employer called in the police, but the workers linked arms and passively resisted removal. On 27th April, clashes broke out between the strikers and the police. 15 workers were injured, with some hospitalized. Previously, the emergency regulations would have been used to call in the police to clear the strikers. And indeed, this had happened just the previous month at Paya Lebar Bus Company. But on 22nd April, a new pro-labour government had been inaugurated. And instead of unequivocally backing the employer and police and ordering arrests of workers, this government condemned the violence and tried to mediate. Meanwhile, the opposition People's Action Party demanded that an investigation be carried out into unprovoked police violence. The police secretary, Clegg, denied that he had received any official reports about the injured or hospitalized workers. Funny that he could have just opened the newspapers. Anyway, this government response was a sea change from the past. The existence of the new pro-labour government changed the nature of strikes. The labour movement was no longer seen through the prism of the emergency as a law and order issue or as a drag on profits. Instead, the government's response was to condemn worker exploitation, police violence, and to support the right of workers to strike. Although, of course, they still worried about communist manipulation. However, Special Branch reported that it had successfully arrested the latest leader of the Malayan Communist Party's Labour Infiltration Branch in Singapore on 30th March 1955. This is just 9 months after they arrested his predecessor. And they confirmed that this branch was no longer an effective unit of the Malayan Communist Party in Singapore. Instead, Special Branch blamed the People's Action Party for the strikes. It said that the PAP was manipulating the situation and using the workers for political gain. And I quote from the report here, the PAP have continued to seize every opportunity to exploit industrial unrest and obviously intend to take advantage of all the freedoms extended by the new government since gaining power. There has been increasing unrest among workers during the month, but no direct indication that this is due to MCP agitation. The PAP appear to be the influence behind these disputes, but as its aims and methods follow so closely those of the MCP, it is difficult to distinguish one from the other. Accusations were thrown about in the Legislative Assembly that the PAP was using the Bus Workers Union to undermine the Labour Front government for selfish political gain. David Marshall warned the trade unions not to be exploited for illegal purposes. At the time, the PAP were pleased to burnish their pro-worker credentials, but then, years later, when writing their version of history, would insist that the bus strike was instigated by the communist underground. The problem for the government at this time was that they didn't have the right tools. It didn't have control of security forces. Existing legislation only permitted them to organise a commission of inquiry to determine the cause of the dispute. This was appointed on 27th April. In the meantime, David Marshall and Minister of Labour Lim Yew Hock continued attempting to mediate the dispute. Marshall was frustrated by the intransigence of Hockley management and accused them of, quote-unquote, trying to blackmail his government. Marshall also met with Lee Kuan Yew in Lee's capacity as legal advisor of the Bus Workers Union. This, along with the suspension of Hockley's bus service, temporarily calmed the situation. The Commission of Inquiry met on 5th May and the Bus Workers Union and its branch union fully cooperated. The Commission ruled in favour of the workers and ordered their reinstatement. The union officials were happy, although the workers remained suspicious. That night, as the workers prepared to return to work, they got wind that the employer would make them fill out forms, which he had never previously asked them to do, before permitting them to return to work. Uncertain of the implications of the forms, they had contacted their legal advisor. And so this is how, at 4 a.m, Lee Kuan Yew found himself outside the home of Hockley's lawyer, trying to wake him up as the lawyer's snarling Alsatian snapped at him. After a long telephone discussion between the two lawyers and the manager, Kwok, it was agreed no forms would be distributed. Indeed, the company lawyer warned Kwok not to do anything foolish. These words went unheeded. When the workers arrived at around 5 a.m., they were ordered to fill out forms before they could return to work. Furious, they stormed out. When Lee later examined the forms, he realized that the forms only asked for information the company already possessed, such as names and badge numbers. It had merely been a psychological ploy by the company to reassert its dominance. The furious workers returned to the picket, and as word spread over the weekend, this is now 7th and 8th of May, more people turned up at the picket, some to gawk, others to join the protest. Attempts by the riot squad to clear the crowd failed as they passively resisted and simply returned when they were carried away. On the 10th of May, the riot squad brought in water hoses. Pieces of the pavement were ripped up by the water and the flying stones injured the workers. The Bus Workers Union angrily condemned the police action. Pointing out that the police action had been entirely legal, it asked, what kind of law permits employers to renege on contracts and workers' agreements, permits the police to employ violence to clear a legitimate strike, but offers workers no protection? The police had even brought along magistrates to observe that their actions were in harmony with the letter of the law. David Marshall, when he went to talk to the strikers, was met with the same explanation. The workers knew their blockade was illegal, but what choice did they have? And that was the problem. The law gave them no protection whatsoever. Was it fair that the employer could get away with his immoral, exploitative behavior and continue making profits while depriving workers of their livelihoods? David Marshall agreed with them. He agreed that the argument was logical, but he also pointed out the fact was, the law is the law. So, the Chinese community at this time furiously debated the morality of illegal resistance to an unjust legal system. You see all these letters coming into the newspapers. However, a survey by the Nanfang Evening Post found public support firmly on the side of the strikers. Meanwhile, the newspapers urged restraint. Given enough time, they said, surely the pro-labour government would amend the labour ordinance and implement a fair and just system. The important thing for now is to avoid more bloodshed. For the trade unionists, however, a principle was at stake. If Hock Lee management and the police prevailed, this would enable employers all over Singapore to continue to tear up agreements and dismiss their employees on a whim. Over the past few years, they had been harassed and threatened and beaten by the police and riot squad officers. But now, with a pro-labour government in power, they had a chance to put a stop to their ill treatment. With so much at stake, the bus workers' union felt it could not possibly back down. It made these points in a statement and emphasised all it wanted was adherence to terms already agreed in the 4th April agreement, along with compensation for the workers' medical fees. It pointed out it had little recourse under existing laws, and the Labour Front government also had its hands tied because the police were still under colonial control. Without any hope for outside help, the bus workers' union decided to organise a general bus strike. The same night, nearly 60 unions met at the Singapore Factory and Shop Workers' Union headquarters and agreed to hold a general strike on 12th and 13th May in support of the strikers and to protest against police violence. On 13th May, Hock Lee management attempted to send out its buses in defiance of the crowd blocking them. The buses drove straight at the crowd, scattering them. In retaliation, the crowd threw stones at the buses, damaging them and forcing them back into the depot. Hock Lee appealed for police help, and the police again brought in water hoses to try to disperse the crowd. This failed. Police Commissioner Nigel Morris, keeping with his policy of preemptively heading off any riots, ordered a full standby of all the police on the island. More police arrived on the scene. Workers on general strike, with nothing to do, arrived to bolster the picket and keep the picket line from being broken. At 3 p.m, afraid that the arriving workers would overwhelm the police, Morris ordered roadblocks. The police sought to cut off all major routes to the Hock Lee Bus Depot on Alexandra Road. However, within their cordon lay Alexandra Brickworks, which itself had a long-running strike, and workers also manning a picket line. It was also home to many European-owned factories with poor industrial relations. At least 6 schools also fell within the cordon. It was Thursday and the factories and schools were open. Students and workers heading home found themselves on the wrong sides of barricades manned by belligerent police. Finally, the roadblocks were spread too thinly and mostly set up on routes leading north, possibly to prevent workers from reaching the affluent European suburb of Tanglin. At 5 p.m, Radio Malaya and Rediffusion broadcasts were interrupted by a police announcement telling people to avoid the Alexandra area as it was dangerous. So, between the end of the working day, the end of the school day, the crowds leaving Great World City, and the announcement, thousands of people were actually trapped within the area, and many more attracted to it out of desire to support the strike or sheer curiosity. And as the sun fell, passions rose. Clashes broke out and escalated, lasting until 3 a.m. Years of pent-up worker anger were unleashed as the police struggled to control the situation. British troops had to be brought in from the Federation to restore control. 31 people were injured and 4 killed, including 2 policemen, an American journalist, and a Chinese student. In the wake of the violence, the Chinese press urged the government to do what it should have done at the beginning, force Hock Lee Bus Company to dissolve its company union, reinstate all dismissed workers and recognize the bus workers' union, and adhere to the terms of the 4th April agreement. Under government pressure, Hock Lee management conceded all terms and signed an agreement of the union and the government at 8 p.m. on 14th May. Even then, the union made a major concession by giving up all pay between 23rd April and 14th May. Even as they grieved for the violence, the Chinese community rejoiced over the settlement of the strike, and Marshall received much of the credit for his moderation and patient mediation. As the human toll of the violence became clear, fingers began pointing. But in these explanations, we can see how different values can affect your view of the same event. Let's first look at it from the trade union perspective. The Singapore Bus Workers Union leader Fong Swee Swan released a statement lamenting the loss of life and blaming it on the excessive violent response of the authorities, which had needlessly antagonized the workers. He wrote, "Instead of showing sympathy for the Hockley bus workers who were dismissed on pretext for no reason by their employer, the authorities, under quote-unquote protection of the Unreasonable Trades Dispute Ordinance, applied corporal punishment on those utterly defenseless workers who were peacefully seeking their own survival. This led to anger on the part of all people, culminating in bloodshed." In the Legislative Assembly, on the other hand, Chief Secretary William Good accused the workers and students of having been manipulated by the People's Action Party into inciting violence for political gain. Because the riot embarrassed the Labour Front government and made the PAP, by comparison, appear more pro-Labour. Governor Nicholl, in his reports to London, also unabashedly took the side of Hock Lee, blaming the Bus Workers Union for rejecting any compromise without noting that any compromise would have been worse than the deal they already agreed to on 4th of April. A special branch investigation concluded that, quote, "the recent labour unrest, which culminated in the clashes between workers and students and the police and in serious rioting, was directed by the leaders of the People's Action Party," unquote. Official consensus believed this was a PAP riot created by utilising quote-unquote communist tactics, but without involvement of the MCP itself. Indeed, the next issue of the Freedom Press, the MCP newsletter, carried an editorial celebrating the workers' triumph, but warning that the violence would make future success more difficult. It urged workers to be less leftist in the future. And indeed, this action goes against the MCP's own line at this time. The MCP had a line of constitutional peaceful action, so this riot could not possibly have been carried out under MCP direction. William Good also accused the Chinese press of, quote, "failing to give any support to the side of law and order," unquote, and acting irresponsibly, while Special Branch complained of, quote, "biased press reports by the Utusan Melayu," unquote. The newspapers had consistently urged compromise and patience. However, Good's interpretations of the editorials and commentary suggest that, to him, anything less than full, unequivocal backing of the authorities and police was perceived as undermining colonial authority. Accordingly, the colonial authorities ordered the Nanyang Shangbao to, quote, "refrain from publishing news in support of workers and students," unquote. We can further see this vast difference in values and perception in Good's description of the riot. His comments, for example, attributed the best of intentions to the police, praised them for their courage and discipline, and personalised them with their English names, Andrew Teo, Kenneth Cole. Good grieved, quote, "for the loss of those two police officers and journalists who were killed doing no more than their duty," unquote. But on the other hand, the workers were depicted as an amorphous, violent mob, and no names of the arrested were given. And you will note that he grieved for three people, but there was a fourth person killed, a student, Chong Lon Chong, who was killed. And the only shots fired were from police revolvers, but Good refused to attribute the bullet that killed Chong to them. Good also made the unsubstantiated claim that the student's body was paraded around for hours and that the student would have lived it if he had been brought to the hospital immediately. But the coroner later told an inquest that, quote, "there is no doubt in my mind that the boy was shot by Police Lieutenant Harris," unquote. But it was impossible to tell the shot had killed him immediately. Nor was it possible to determine if the men who carried him into the hospital had acted irresponsibly or simply found it impossible to reach the hospital in the midst of the riot. And the jury returned an open verdict. Good also neglected to mention that the four men who brought Chong to the hospital were promptly arrested, released at 4 p.m. the same day, rearrested the next morning, released that afternoon, then recalled to the Criminal Investigation Department the day after. And at least one of them was badly beaten while in custody and was hospitalized. In his response to Good, Lee Kuan Yew argued that the colonial authorities, unable to comprehend the workers' bitterness and anger, had succumbed to false conclusions and resorted to violence out of fear of the unknown. He said, quote, "It is a difficulty of people from other countries of never understanding the Asian mind, and they try to hide their embarrassment behind a sneer," unquote. The colonial inability to understand the perspective of the workers and their insistence on seeing the problem as a law and order issue was creating a vicious cycle. Violent reactions to repression were explained by conspiracy theories, which led to more repression, which led to more violent reactions against the repression. And these differing interpretations of Hockley continue to present day. In many ways, your values drive your interpretation. Do you feel law and order and peace is more important? Or do you feel that ending discrimination and fighting back against exploitation and virtual enslavement is more important? Is it moral to fight, illegally resist an unjust, immoral law? Your answer to that in many ways determines your attitude to Hock Lee. It's a litmus test for your values. The Hock Lee strike, however, also has great significance for Singapore's politics because it marked another step forward in the evolution of the anti-colonial movement. On the surface, it immediately altered the complexion of the labour movement. The trade unionists realised that their activities would no longer be suppressed. They became active again, reactivating dormant unions, organising new ones, and they began exerting their rights, demanding that employers treat workers fairly and pay fair wages. Employers continued to resist, but the trade unions were no longer being held back by the government. And so over the next year, strike activity shot up from 0.31 man days lost per employee in 1954 to 2.15 man days lost per employee in 1955. And most strikes would be successful. But more than that, Hock Lee opened a new stage in the anti-colonial movement. With genuine trade unions once again being able to operate, they would form the basis of a new left-wing progressive movement. And it is here that many of the strands that we have been discussing in the previous few weeks come together. Because this is the beginning of a new era of mass politics and associational democracy in Singapore. This is where we have our first mass political movements formed around coalitions of common political interests, who group together to fight for political change. It's no coincidence it starts with the workers, who face the worst exploitation, which affected people's lives the most intimately. Faced with systemic discrimination, they formed trade unions to protect themselves, to fight for their rights. And then once the government stopped using force to crack down and suppress them, they flourished. And their successful example will be quickly copied all over Singapore across all sorts of interest groups. Mutual associations sprang up in areas which experienced colonial discrimination, including rural residents, culture, and of course education, which I just spent 4 episodes talking about. But more than that, the reason for the systemic discrimination and exploitation is not just employers or specific government policies, it's the entire colonial system. So the trade unions and all the other associations recognized that to get genuine change, they also needed to be represented in politics. They needed to form mass political movements who could provide electoral support and the votes to get their chosen representatives elected into government. Only then could they change the government policy. Only then could they elect a left-wing progressive labor government that protects minorities. But this isn't just for government. The stakes are much higher. This is against an entire system of colonial oppression. You need an overwhelming, united, anti-colonial coalition, or the colonial government can play its usual divide and conquer. So workers alone aren't enough. You must have anti-colonial unity across the entire spectrum. So the workers and the students and the cultural groups and the rural residents and all the other minority and oppressed groups in Singapore would eventually seek to join together in a common anti-colonial platform. And so over the next few weeks, I will describe this new era of associational politics, associational democracy, which would culminate in a mass movement that would shake the colonial administration to its very foundations. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the show, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.